This is a reading of the early lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Christian Mystery. This is section 5.5, entitled The Lord's Prayer Considered Esoterically, Part 1, given on January 28, 1907 in Berlin. Today I would like to suggest the extent to which religious systems, in specific instances, reveal their hidden spiritual scientific foundations. It is a small but important aspect of the esoteric scientific basis of religions that I want to discuss. Even the simplest people in contemporary society recognize this hidden background of religions as a spiritual fact involving the deepest truths. Searching out these truths illuminates the degree that wisdom and mystery fill the ties that hold together the spiritual life of humankind. Let's consider the Christian prayer. You all know what it is. It has been discussed and reflected upon often here in terms of its relationship to the spiritual scientific worldview. This spiritual scientific worldview has brought to members of our movement another method of elevating the human being, the human soul, to contact with the divine spiritual cosmic forces. This method is meditation, by which a person experiences the spiritual content within, receiving something of what is given by the great guiding spirits of humanity, or by the spiritual content of great civilizations, where human beings immerse themselves and so identify with the divine spiritual currents in the world. A person may be brought into union with the higher spirituality by meditating, even in the simplest way, on one of the formulas pronounced by the spiritual leaders of humanity, by allowing into the mind a formula that embodies a great thought, and letting such a formula really live in the heart and experience. Not just any thought is suitable, as you know, but only one handed down for this purpose by the guiding spirits of humanity. A higher power, in which one lives, streams through and patient perseverance to the point of allowing this flow of forces to strengthen one enough morally and intellectually, brings the moment when the subject of one's meditation can awaken the deeper forces latent in the human soul. This kind of meditation may reach any of a number of stages, from the smallest gain in moral strength to the highest attainments of clairvoyance. But time, patience, and energy are needed to bring most people to the higher degrees of clairvoyance by this means. Meditation is generally considered to be an Eastern approach to the divine. In the West, especially in Christian communities, prayer has replaced it. It is through prayer that Christians customarily approach the divine, and through it they seek entry to the higher worlds. It should be noted, incidentally, that what passes for prayer today would by no means have been considered such in early Christian times, least of all by the founder of Christianity, Jesus Christ himself. For if, in fact, someone were to gain the gratification of personal wishes through prayer, or entreaty, that person would soon disregard the all-embracing effect of the prayer entirely. One would assume that the deity granted one's own wishes rather than those of others. A farmer might pray for sunshine for a particular crop, a different farmer for rain to help another crop. What would divine providence do in that event? Or suppose two opposing armies are facing each other, with each side praying for victory and assuming its cause alone to be just. Such an example immediately makes it obvious how little universality and sense of community attach to prayers arising from personal desires, and the granting of such prayers by God can satisfy only one group of supplicants. People so praying disregard the prayer in which Jesus Christ presented the fundamental attitude of mind that should prevail in all prayer. Father, quote, Father, let this cup pass from me, nevertheless not my will but yours be done, unquote. This is the Christian attitude of prayer. Whatever the object of the prayer, this fundamental temper of mind must echo readily as an undertone in the soul of the petitioner for the prayer to be given in a Christian manner. When this is the character of the plea, the form of prayer will be but a means of rising to higher spiritual realms, to experience the divinity within the soul. It will be such, moreover, as to expel every selfish wish and will impulse. Its spirit will be that of the words, quote, not my will, but yours be done." Unquote. The result will be a rising to the divine world and absorption in it. Attainment of this soul mood in Christian prayer renders it similar to meditation, though more colored by feeling. Originally, Christian prayer was not essentially different from meditation. Meditation is more imbued with thought, however. Through it, the thoughts of the great leaders of humankind draw the one who meditates onward toward harmony with the divine current streaming through the world. Through feeling, prayer accomplishes the same result. The goal of both prayer and meditation is thus clearly the soul's union with the divine currents in the world. This union on the highest plane is the so-called unio mystical, mystical union with the Godhead. Never could the human being attain to this union with God, never could he gain a relationship with higher spiritual beings, were he himself not an emanation of the divine spiritual. Human nature is twofold, as you know. There are the four often mentioned human principles, the physical body, etheric or life body, astral body, and I-being. Then, within the I, one has the possibility of unfolding for the future the three higher principles, manas, buddhi, and atman, known in our Western languages as spirit self, life spirit, and spirit body. To understand this twofold human nature correctly, let us consider the period during which humankind originated. You will recall from previous lectures that the human being is a blend of these two natures, a blend of the three higher potentials, spirit self, life spirit, and spirit body, with the four existing lower principles, physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I, which were developed in an ancient past that we call the Earth's Lemurian epoch. Tracing the human being back from the present epoch through the Greco-Latin, Egypto-Chaldean, Persian, and Indian periods of humanity to the great Atlantean flood, recorded in the deluge myths of all peoples, we reach our ancestors who lived on the land mass we call Atlantis, between today's Europe and America. Even farther back we come to a primeval land mass we call Lemuria, between Australia and India. It was in the middle of that Lemurian period that the higher triad of spirit self, life spirit, and spirit body united with the four lower human principles, physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I-being. Strictly speaking, during that period in the Lemurian epoch, the highest being on earth was not yet a physical human being in our sense of the word. There was only a kind of envelope made up of the highest animal nature, a being or collection of beings made up of the four lower principles of human nature. But until then, the higher human being, which is the internal part of human nature destined to evolve further and further in the future, through the three principles of spirit self, life spirit, and spirit body, rested in the bosom of the Godhead. To imagine the scene at that time, using a trivial modern comparison, it was as though all the people living on earth were, quote, budding, unquote, bodies, capable of receiving a human soul as a sponge absorbs water. Picture a vessel of water. It is impossible to tell where one drop of water ends and another begins. But picture also a number of little sponges immersed in the water, each soaking up a part of it. What had been a uniform mass of water is now distributed among the many little sponges. So it was with human souls in that remote age. Previously, they had been at rest, without individuality, in the bosom of the divine first cause. But at that particular moment they were absorbed by human bodies, and so individualized, like the water by the sponges. What was then absorbed by the separate bodies, or four lower principles, continued to evolve further, and will so continue into the future. In spiritual science, it has always been called the higher triad, and the triangle and the square were made symbols, especially in the Pythagorean school, of human beings as they came into existence at the middle of the Lemurian epoch. The diagram on the next page thus represents the constituent elements of the divine, of the human being. The picture has a triangle and right below it a square, and at the vertices of the triangle at the top we have Our Father in the Heavens, Your Will Be Done, Will, Spirit Body. To the left, that vertex says Your Kingdom Come, Kingdom, the life spirit, and the vertex to the right of the triangle, on the right side of the triangle, your name be hallowed, name, spirit self. Down below is the square in the upper left. It says ego, evil, deliver us from the evil. Upper right says astral body, temptation, lead us not into temptation. Lower left, physical body, give us today our daily bread. Lower right, etheric body, guilt, debt, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. The higher, eternal portion that passes through all incarnations, however, has a double character, as you can see. From one side, it may be seen as the primordial, eternal element of humanity, and from the other as a drop of the divine essence given up by the Godhead, poured into the fourfold human vessel. Consequently, a drop of the independently individualized divinity may be found in each of us. The three higher members of the human being, the eternal portion, may thus be viewed as the three highest principles in the human being, but equally as three principles in the Godhead itself. In fact, the three highest principles of human nature are at the same time the three lowest principles of the divinity nearest to the human being. An enumeration of the human being's principles must begin with the physical body, continue with the etheric body, astral body, and I, and proceed from spirit self to spirit body. But we must begin with spirit self, continue with life spirit and spirit body, for a corresponding enumeration of the principles of those divine beings who gave a drop of their own soul nature to human beings at the time we are speaking of, in the ancient past. We then proceed to principles above spirit body, which can be conceived of only by those today who are pupils of initiates. You see that the three principles of higher human nature may be seen as three divine principles, and today we shall consider them in that way, not as human, but as divine principles, and describe them accordingly. In the terminology of spiritual or esoteric science, the spirit body is the highest principle within us, which we shall develop only at the end of our earth incarnations, or at the end of our present planetary course, so to speak. The original essence of this human principle is vaguely comparable to the will element in contemporary human nature. This comparison is not precise, but only a slight indication. Nevertheless, the essential character of this highest divine principle within us has the nature of will, or a kind of willing. This will element in us, which today is only tenuously developed within our being, will become in the course of our ever-ascending development the predominating principle within us. Human beings today are essentially conscious, understanding beings. In many ways, however, the will is limited. We understand the world around us as a totality, to a certain degree anyway, but we have no real control over all that we understand with our knowledge. This control by the will is a development for the future, and it will become increasingly stronger until we attain that primary goal of existence known to spiritual science as the quote-unquote great sacrifice. That is, the power of the will to sacrifice oneself completely, not merely in the pittances of human sacrifice that contemporary human beings are capable of with their feeble feelings and willpower. In the future, people will have developed the necessary strength to sacrifice their whole being by allowing it to flow directly into material substance. This great sacrifice, the highest expression of will in divine nature, may be imagined by picturing oneself before a mirror where one's image is reflected. This image is an illusion and a semblance of course. Now, take this image to the point of imagining yourself as dying, as sacrificing your existence, your feeling and thought, your very being, to inject life into that image. Spiritual science in all ages has called this phenomenon the outpouring, the emanation. If you could really make this sacrifice, it would be clear that you would no longer be here, because you would have given up your whole being to this reflected image to imbue it with life and consciousness. When the will has become capable of making the great sacrifice, it actually creates a universe, great or small, whose mission is bestowed upon it by its creator. Such is the creative will in the divine being. The second principle in the Godhead, life spirit, insofar as it has flowed into humanity, has already been suggested by the comparison with a mirror. This second principle is the reflected image itself. Now imagine the inner being of a divinity that has in this way created a universe with itself as the center. If, for example, you imagine yourself as the central point in this room, surrounded not by these six surfaces of walls, ceiling, and floor, but by a hollow globe that reflects its content, you will see yourself as the central point, reflecting on all sides everywhere. In like manner, you can picture a divinity as a central will reflected on all sides, and the mirror is image of both divinity and the universe. For what is a universe? It is nothing but a mirror of the essential nature of divinity. The universe lives and moves because the divinity is poured into it, the outpouring, when divinity makes the great sacrifice and is reflected in the universe. The pouring of life and being into a reflected image is an exact picture of this divine creative process. The divine will expresses itself in infinite diversity, animating thereby the entire universe. In spiritual science, this process of divinity, repeating itself in infinite differentiation, in multiplicity, is known as the kingdom, distinguished from the will itself. The will is the central point, its reflection, the kingdom. The will is, in this sense, comparable to spirit body. The kingdom's or will's reflected image is like life spirit. The kingdom, in turn, reproduces the being of the divine in infinite variety. Observe it fully, at least to the degree that it is our kingdom, our multiplicity, our universe. Observe its visible manifestations in minerals, plants, animals, and human beings. The kingdom is manifested in each separate being of all these, a fact that even our language expresses in the terms mineral kingdom, vegetable kingdom, animal kingdom, and all the great divisions of our universe. The kingdom is all these. Each of these, in turn, is a kingdom. And if we observe the mass of details involved, we find the nature of all to be divine. In all of them the divine being is reflected, just as the central being is reflected in a hollow globe. So an observer, looking at the world in the sense of spiritual research, sees God reflected in every human being as an expression and image of the divine. In a graded series of beings, in infinite diversity, the Godhead appears in the kingdom, and the separate entities are distinguished from one another in the sense of spiritual science by their names. An observer, at a stage of existence sufficiently lofty to look upon all these separate entities as emanations or outpourings of the divine, is able to give these entities their names, to give each manifestation of the divine its name. Of all beings in the universe, only human beings consider the name of each of the separate members of the great multiplicity of the kingdom, distinguishing each from all the others. The will, as we have noted, is comparable to spirit body. The kingdom, or the reflected image into which the will has been poured out, is comparable to life spirit. The third of the three highest human principles that emanate from the divine, by which the separate members of the great multiplicity of the kingdom are distinguished from one another and separately named, is comparable to spirit self. The esoteric science of the different religions has thus simply taught what it was that emanated from the Godhead and flowed into a person to become his or her eternal image or archetype. Thus, if you could see yourselves in that condition to which you should finally rise, the condition of spirit body, you would recognize its will-like nature. If you would rise in thought to a comprehension of the vehicle of will, spirit body, in other words, to life spirit, you would see that it is the kingdom that represents it in the divine sphere. If you would rise to penetrate what the names or conceptions or ideas of things really mean in spirit, you would see that it is the name that represents this wisdom in the divine sphere. So does ancient teaching reveal that the emanations of divinity, which has flowed into human nature to form its eternal part, consists of name, of kingdom, of will. Thus, what is called the higher triad in the human being is recognizable as part of the divine. To complete this picture, consider the four lower principles of perishable human nature. We know that the three higher principles may be thought of as principles of the Godhead. Similarly, the four lower principles may be considered as of the perishable world, as human principles. Think of the physical body, which is composed of the same substances and forces as is the seemingly lifeless world around it. The physical body could not go on existing without the inflow into it of matter and force from the surrounding world. The physical body, strictly speaking, is a passageway for all that is in it. The substances that at one moment belong to the outer world and at another to us continuously flow into the body and out of it again. The entire material composition of the human body is renewed during the span of 7 years, as we have mentioned in other connections. None of you contain the substances that you contained 10 years ago. We continuously renew the substances of our physical body. What was previously within us now exists elsewhere, distributed outside us in nature. Something else has replaced it within us. The body's life depends on this continual inflow and outflow of matter. Just as we have considered the three higher human principles as aspects of divinity, we may see the four principles of our lower nature as parts of divine nature. The physical body may be viewed as part of the physical substance of our planet. Its substance is taken from the material planet and then is returned to it. Likewise, the etheric body may be considered a part of the environment surrounding us here, as may the astral body. Consider the etheric body and the astral body together. The astral body, as you know, is the vehicle of all that lives in the human being as impulse, desire, and passion, all that flows in the ups and downs of the soul as joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain. The etheric body, on the other hand, is the vehicle that represents and carries within it the more enduring qualities of soul. Often I have compared the development of the etheric body and astral body with the hour hand and the minute hand of a clock, respectively. You may observe a great difference between what you knew and experienced as an 8-year-old and what you now know and have experienced, as I have also reminded you on other occasions. You have learned much and gained many concepts in the meantime. Much of the joy and sorrow that your soul has taken in has left it again. It has, in fact, passed through it. How different are these relatively ephemeral experiences from such human elements as temperament, character, and tendencies that are persisting and continuing. You will find, for example, that if you are inclined to be passionate as a child, you probably are still that way during your later years. Most people retain throughout their lives elements that are so basic to their nature. Spiritual training and development are established in order to overcome this relatively static quality of the etheric organism. For, as often emphasized, such training is not merely a matter of theoretical knowledge. Indeed, students have accomplished a great deal when they have managed to change one quality of temperament to which they are predisposed, thus speeding up the hour hand of the clock even a little. Whatever evolves slowly in this way, a human being's lasting tendencies, enduring qualities of temperament, habits that persist, is rooted in the etheric body. Whatever changes quickly, by contrast, like the minute hand, has its roots in the astral body. Applying these facts in a practical way to human beings, within their environment, and to life in the outer world, the observer notices people's relationships to the epoch in which they live, within a nation or within a family, all of which are revealed by habits, temperament, and enduring inclinations. These relatively fixed and abiding qualities tend to be observable not only in the individuals, but also in anyone with whom they are in any way connected, with family, nation, and so on. A nation's individuals are recognizable through their common habits and temperament. People must change their individual dispositions and basic habits so that they can achieve higher spiritual development and unfold their higher nature. Such people are called homeless in the language of spiritual science, because they must transform the etheric body through which they have been connected, except for this higher development, with their nation. Life in one's native community also reveals that the qualities linking one to a family or nation, stirring one to feel relationships with individual people of the nation, are also similar to qualities that can be seen widely in one's era. If an ancient Greek were to walk into your life, you would have little in common. That person's etheric body would be very unlike yours. Human beings understand one another through common qualities in their etheric bodies. Within the astral body, however, is rooted our ability to lift ourselves more readily out of certain qualities that bind us to a common life with one another, qualities that allow us to establish ourselves as separate individuals in our family, with our people, so that we are not merely French, American, or German, nor merely members of a family, but stand out as unique individuals within the family, within the people, family, and so on. Thus we can outgrow the totality of national traits. The qualities we transcend are rooted in the astral body. The astral body carries them. The astral body is therefore seen to carry more of the individual and personal within us. Consequently, faults committed through the etheric body make us sinners more toward others through neglecting obligations and conditions that make social life possible among us. On the other hand, faults of a more individual nature, one's wrong actions as a separate personality, result from qualities in the astral body. Spiritual science has always referred to the sins committed against the community as guilt. They originate in a faulty etheric body. The more common English word, debts, has in German an origin similar to the word guilt, with its more moral connotation in English, indicating what one person owes another morally. Debt or guilt derives from defective qualities in the etheric body, whereas a defective element in the astral body leads to what spiritual science associates with the word temptation. Those who yield to temptation assume a personal fault or failing. The I, or true personality, can commit faults as well. The paradise story indicates the kind of fault through which an I being may fall. The human being's higher soul became an I when it descended from the bosom of the Godhead and entered an earthly body for the first time. It was taken up by the earthly body like a drop of water by a sponge. The higher soul, or individuality, can commit faults within the I being. These failures of the I, which are different from those stemming from faulty qualities of the etheric and astral bodies, occur through the very fact of a man's attaining independence. To rise gradually in full consciousness to freedom and independence, human beings had to pass through selfishness and egoism. As souls, they are descended from the Godhead, which is incapable of egoism. A member of an organism never imagines itself independent. If a finger were to imagine itself independent, it would fall away from the rest of the hand and wither. The self-dependence that is so necessary to human development, and that will attain its full meaning when selflessness becomes its fundamental nature, could originate only from selfishness. When this selfishness entered the human body, human beings became self-seeking and egoistic. The I naturally follows the body's inclinations. Human beings devour one another, following selfish impulses and desires. They are completely entangled in their earthly receptacles, as the drops of water in the sponge. The paradise story shows the individual is placed in a position to sin just by having become an individual, a truly independent being. Whereas previously human beings drew in what they needed from the universe, just as a single drop in a mass of water derives its force from the mass, impulses in the human being as a fully independent individuality derive wholly from that individual. The eating of the apple in paradise indicates this kind of error, which stemmed from independence. It is significant, too, that the Latin word malum means both evil and apple. All real meanings of words, provided, of course, that they have their esoteric background, are deeply connected in an inner sense. Spiritual science never uses the word evil for any transgression that does not stem from the I. Evil is therefore a fault that arises from the eye. Trespass or guilt is fault that arises from the etheric body of a human being within social relationships. Temptation may assail the astral body in whatever way it is individually and personally at fault. Thus, the fault of the etheric body is debts or guilt, the fault of the astral body is temptation, and the fault of the eye is evil. Consider the relationship of the four lower principles of human nature to their environment, that is, the planetary conditions surrounding them. The physical body continually takes in physical substance as nourishment. In this way it maintains its existence. The etheric body's life, in a finite condition, is possible only when fellowship is maintained with those into whose community one has grown. The astral body is maintained by overcoming temptation. The eye is maintained and undergoes development in the right way by not yielding to the threat of evil. Now bring before your mind's eye the whole human being, the lower quaternary and the higher triad. In this way you can say that within individual human beings there lives a drop of divinity. All are evolving to the divine through the expression of their deepest, innermost nature. By expressing outwardly that deepest, innermost nature, they reveal that they have gone through gradual development transmuted. Let me read that again. By expressing outwardly that deepest, innermost nature, they reveal that they have, through gradual development, transmuted individual being into what Christianity calls the Father. What is hidden in the human soul and hovers before humanity as its great goal is called the, quote, Father in Heaven, unquote. Those who wish to attain that degree of development must be capable of bringing the higher triad and lower quaternary to the point where they can maintain the physical body adequately. The etheric body must live socially so that an adjustment is effected with whatever exists of trespass within it. The astral body must not perish in temptation, nor the eye being fall into evil. Human beings must strive upward toward the Father in Heaven through the three higher principles, the name, the kingdom, and the will. The name must be experienced in such a way that it becomes hallowed. Look around. All things in their diversity express the Godhead. By calling each thing by its name, you make it a member of the divine order of the world. By seeing some element that reveals in it a principle of the divine being within every single thing or being that you name in your environment, you help to make each part of your environment sacred. You hallow each element. You grow into the kingdom, which is the outpouring of divinity, and develop yourself up to the will, which is spirit-body, and a principle of the Godhead at the same time. Think now of one who meditates and concentrates totally upon this meaning of human development, and who wishes to gather this meaning, the seven principles of human spiritual evolution, into seven petitions in prayer. How will such a person pray? To express the aim of the prayer, the person will have to begin, before speaking the seven petitions, quote, Our Father in the heavens, unquote. In this form of salutation, the human being is concerned with the deepest foundation of the human soul, the innermost element of the human being, which Christian esoteric teaching characterizes as of the kingdom of spirit. The link of the first three petitions, which follow this exalted salutation, is with the three higher principles of human nature, with the divine substance within human beings, quote, Your name be hallowed, your kingdom come, unquote. The prayer now moves from the spiritual to the earthly kingdom. Quote, Your will be done, as in heaven, so also on earth, unquote. The four last petitions are linked with the four lower principles of human nature. What appeal is the supplicant to make with reference to the physical body that it be sustained within the planetary life? Quote, Give us today our daily bread, unquote. What should one say in relation to sustaining the etheric body? Quote, And forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, unquote. What is asked for here is the adjustment of what takes place through the transgressions of the etheric body. What is one now to ask with regard to the astral body? Quote, and lead us not into temptation, unquote. And with regard to the eye, quote, deliver us from the evil, unquote. The seven petitions of the Lord's Prayer are thus seen to express that the human soul, when it aspires properly, beseeches divine will for a development of the seven elements in human nature that enable one to find the right course of life in the universe, a proper development of all these seven elements. Through using the Lord's Prayer, the petitioner may rise to an understanding of the full meaning of the development of the seven principled human nature. It follows that even when the users of these seven petitions are the simplest people who do not necessarily understand any of them, such petitions express for them as well the spiritual scientific view of human nature. All formulas for meditation in the world's great religious societies throughout history have had their origins in spiritual science. Analyze every true prayer that exists, word for word, and you will find it to be no arbitrary stringing together of words. Never has a mere blind impulse been followed to string together so many beautiful words, never at all. Rather, the great sages have adopted these forms of prayer from the wisdom teaching now called spiritual science. Every true form of prayer was born of this great knowledge, and Jesus Christ, the great initiate who established Christianity, had in mind the seven principles of human nature when he taught his prayer, expressing in it the seven principled nature of humankind. All prayers are arranged in this way. If they were not, their power could not have continued to be exercised for thousands of years. Only this arrangement is effective, even among simple people who do not have the least understanding of the deep meaning of the words. A comparison between human life and what occurs in nature will make more understandable this appeal of true prayer to the simplest of people. Observe a plant. It delights you, although you may know nothing at all of the great universal laws according to which it has come into existence. It is there, and may have interest for you. But it would never have been created if primal, eternal laws had not existed according to which the necessary creative forces flowed into it. There is no need for simple natures to know these laws at all, but if a plant is to be created, it must be produced according to them. Similarly, a prayer that is not issued from the fountainhead of wisdom has no real meaning for either the learned or the simple. It is in our present time that those who have so long observed the plant and received its blessing can be led to the wisdom in these great universal laws. For 2,000 years, the Christian has been praying in the same way that an unscientific person observes a plant. The time is coming when such a person will discern the power possessed by prayer, power that has flowed into being from the deep source of wisdom. Every prayer, especially the Lord's Prayer, which is central to Christian life, expresses this primeval wisdom. Light manifests in the world in seven colors, and the fundamental sound in seven tones. Similarly, the sevenfold human being aspiring upward to God is expressed in the seven different feelings of aspiration that relate to the seven principled human nature and are expressed in the seven petitions of the Lord's Prayer. Thus, in an esotericist's soul, this prayer expresses the seven principled human being. The end of Lecture 5.5.